WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Cleese is known for his work with Monty Python's Flying Circus, Fawlty Towers, The Life of Brian, and A Fish Called Wanda. But when I spoke with Cleese this past June, he had come to Philadelphia to participate in a family therapy conference. He led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner. The two had collaborated on the 1983 book Families and How to Survive Them. Now they're working on a second book. Anyone who's seen Cleese's work would imagine that he's a little eccentric. But it was depression and a failing marriage that brought him to therapist Skinner. For 3 years in the mid-70s, Cleese attended a therapy group co-led by Skinner and his wife Pearl. Robin Skinner is a founder of the Institute of Group Analysis and the Institute of Family Therapy in England. Cleese and Skinner came to our studio, and I asked John Cleese if it was important to him to have a therapist who was attuned to the absurdities in life.
The ideas that I was hearing in that therapy group were extremely different from the ideas that I'd grown up with. I'm talking primarily about the sort of attitudes towards men-women relationships. Terribly different from what I'd grown up with in this tiny little town, in a little seaside town called Weston-super-Mare, population 30,000, in a very small town. And after a few weeks, I remember quite distinctly thinking, well, this is quite contrary, these kind of attitudes, quite contrary to what I've believed in the past, but I'm going to make a sort of act of faith and go with it for a few weeks. And I think the reason I was able to do that is that there was something about Robin that I instinctively trusted. And that was that he never grasped onto anything very strongly, that he would say something and then almost humorously pull the carpet away from under you just shortly afterwards. And there was something there that appealed to me, and I think it's connected with my sense of humor.
Robin Skinner, was John Cleese funny in the group? and at the beginning, did he try to be funny before he relaxed into the group?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he is very funny. He isn't funny in the way he is in Monty Python. I mean, he's a very amusing companion, very witty. And, of course, some of that came into the group, and other people were amused by it. But in general, he was quite natural.
You will also find, I mean, an enormous number of comics are depressed, I suppose. 80% of the comics that I'm familiar with in England and America, and they're names that would be well recognized by your audience, I think, have a very strong depressive side. And it's got a great irony that they spend all their lives cheering other people up. But if you meet them, they tend to be rather quiet people, with a few exceptions. There are some people who are just never off, and they're awfully tiring to be around. I mean, they just do their cabaret act to you for hours if you go out to dinner. But the others tend to be rather quiet and sometimes to have this very slightly mournful quality to them. The manic defense, in other words, is not used by most of them.
Do you think of yourself as that way? And is that something that you've drawn on that you wouldn't in a way be anxious to get rid of? The melancholy.
I think that I was very depressed when I went into Robin's group. And I think that most of the 3 years that I spent in the group was in a sense learning to be sad instead of depressed. I mean, Robin, as we say in the book, I think Robin puts it that depression is blocked sadness. You can actually relax through the depression into the sadness and feel the sadness that is underneath there, which may be something to do with your childhood, and actually go through that, then you can kind of unload it, right, Robin?
Come out the other side.
Yes. And I think that I still have occasional moments of depression, but it's not a sort of continual heavy weight on me as it was in the early mid-70s. And indeed, probably most of the time I was making Python, 69 to 73. It was a time when I didn't feel well for about 10 months in the year.
Did that have to do with the work, or was that just personal?
I think it was a combination of the two, and it was necessary for me in 73 to say to the others, look, I don't want to work with the group anymore. I felt that 10 months a year was more than I wanted to work with them. Funny, I've just said I was ill for 10 months in the year. So
you think it was the depression that was part of the reason why you left?
I think it was partly that I was not able to be aware of some of the emotions in my relationship with my wife, and I wasn't therefore able to cope with them. because I wasn't aware of them, wasn't expressing them, wasn't dealing with them. I think that was partly it. And also because I find that working in a group is enormously rewarding some of the time, but I very much need my own space. And what was happening in Python is becoming so successful that the others wanted to be doing it 10 months in the year. And I sort of said to them, look, I wanted to make comedy shows with you. I didn't want to be married to you. And then there was a little bad feeling when I told them in 73 that I didn't want to do the next television series. But they had actually, I looked at my diaries the other day, they put an awful lot of pressure on me to do the third series, which I didn't really want to do. And they just didn't listen to my resistance, you know, where they steamrolled me. And I remember Terry Gilliam, he just didn't believe that I wasn't actually keen to go on. They just thought it was me doing some act to get some attention. They just didn't take it seriously. And when I went in the end, a couple of them, mainly Graham Chapman and Terry Jones, were very cross with me for going and talked to me, as I said, about my betraying the group and all this. So I thought it was just a lot of childish nonsense. I mean, the fact was that they were a little bit scared about earning a living outside the group, and the fact that I wanted to go off on my own threatened the group. And as I said, I never married them.
You say in the book Families and How to Survive Them that most problems that we have as adults are grounded in our family experience, our early family experience. Let me ask you, John Cleese, about your early family experience. Now, your parents were in your 40s when they had you.
That's right. I was 46 and my mother was 40.
And your father was 46.
My father. Yeah. Is that what I said?
You said you were 46.
That's interesting. I was 46. My second daughter was born.
Did you want to analyze what this means?
Many a true word spoken in jest, yes.
Yeah, I was born a little bit with pipe and slippers. I've always been rather middle-aged. That's very funny. Now, I was 46 when my second daughter was born, and I think that was kind of strange because it's late for someone to have a child.
So were you the kid whose parents were older than all the other parents?
Absolutely, and had been married for 13 years before I arrived, and everybody was astounded when they suddenly announced they were going to have a child because they'd been sort of marked down as not going to have children. And I think that the fact that they were old and therefore probably a bit more cautious and a bit more protective affected me. I still wince if anybody turns the television on too loudly in my house, because my mother was always saying, "Don't you know, it's too noisy, it'll disturb the neighbours." I've got very, very strong sort of lower middle class respectability streak in me, which I hate.
Now, so much of your humour has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman, and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his
Oh, yes, I'm
associates.
Sure that's right. And also, you see, it was nothing surprising about the fact that Fawlty Towers was set in nominally in Torquay, which is just a place exactly like Weston-super-Mare, only a bit bigger, but with exactly the same attitudes. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle-class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie Finney sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work meetings often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off. And they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life, too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait. Can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they might glupose and never call it the Murga chooses. There's to be across the bottom, part of Isaac cruise together in mid slever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're...
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yeah, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958, and I've never forgotten it. It got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? Is it? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No. So, you know, I always like very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually like one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that?
Oh yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right. Yeah. No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then of course it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staidish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
No, yeah, you say your public school education, which, of course, in America would be private school.
That's right. I take your audience on NPR as being so well-informed that they would know that.
So this was a school for, like, well-bred,
upper middle class? Yeah, professional, yes.
So you really learned...
I learned how to present myself. In fact, I mean, I was moving up a class by going to a school like that because most of my friends had sort of fathers who were doctors and lawyers and this kind of thing rather than salesmen. But my father had a very okay accent and was kind of interested in the English language, always had a dictionary by his desk, but he'd left school at 15 or 16, and my mother was not particularly well educated, but they had the right accent, they spoke good English, and they had just enough money to send me to one of these public schools as a day boy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting. Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the city of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. And if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
He's grinning.
So much of the Monty Python stuff and of your humor outside of Python had to do with seeing the incongruities and absurdities, creating incongruities to show off the daily absurdities of life.
Yeah, pointing them out, really. Wasn't it Will Rogers who said, I don't make the jokes, I just point them out?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if he said it, but yeah.
Yeah, I always felt that's what we were doing.
Well, so I'm wondering if you ever... we're interested in Dada or surrealism, you know, if there's like intellectual roots to the kind of incongruities that you were doing, if that just was what you naturally gravitated to.
Never very strong. Yeah. I never particularly resonated to any of their stuff, although there was a cup and saucer in the Museum of Modern Art.
In fur lined? Yeah.
Who was it who did that? Do you remember?
It's a woman. I love that piece.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally you see something like it, you think that is just terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the whole, no. I mean, I think I led into my type of humor through all the comedy shows I used to listen to. And as I always say, at least two-thirds, probably three-quarters of the ones that I really loved in my formative stages were American. It was all Jack Benny. It was George Burns in particular, it was Phil Silvers, who was absolutely fantastic. And then later on, it was Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Jonathan Winters and, you know, incredible richness. And then, of course, the great classics, the Keatons and the Chaplins and the Laurel and Hardys. And you see in there, although, of course, Chaplin and Laurel were English, I mean, they worked in America, there were really only one or two English groups or individual comedians. A guy called Tony Hancock, who was wonderful and isn't known over here at all. And, of course, the Goons, who's, you know, outstanding member was Peter Sellers. But most of the influences were American. But I always loved comedy. If there's something funny happened, I used to write it down in the little book that we were given at school each term. There was something strange going on. It never occurred to me I'd do anything other than become a solicitor or something.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies in England, but that's a minority thing. It's basically it's the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills.
But still, you have to do films that have to be approved of by top executives in large corporations, right?
No, because we make them with our own money. I mean, if somebody like, for example, Volvo came to us to make a couple of commission films 10 years ago, I remember them because I was in them, then, of course, we very much listen to what sort of film they want to make and understand what the information or attitude that they want to put across. But that's sort of 5% of our work. 95% of it is making films with our own money. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn. If they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious. If they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise, and he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise? Oh, hello. A sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh metallic sound.
What, steady or pulsating or measured or intermittent or seasonal or cyclical or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm wondering if you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, we founded the company in 1972, and I'm proud to say that it's now the biggest company of its kind in the world outside the States. We've been making that claim for 10 years, and I'm sure it's right because nobody's ever contested it. And I find that making the films that we do, like, for example, the recent one I made was just on really showing a manager how to coach his subordinates, is not only very interesting, but I actually believe it's enormously worthwhile. I think it helps to move business and therefore society in slightly healthier directions and ways of operating, which very much chime in with the sort of ideas of what is mental health that Robin and I discuss all the time, which incidentally our second book's all about.
I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But So before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and get the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do basically because you were trying to build your career.
John Cleese is my guest, and also with us is Robin Skinner. And for 3 years, Skinner was Cleese's therapist, and they've actually collaborated on a book together about therapy called Families and How to Survive Them. Robin Skinner, we've been seeing a great example of how incredibly articulate John Cleese is. And I wonder if that kind of ability to really describe things in precise detail is something that works to your advantage or your disadvantage when you're in therapy. And the advantages are obvious because you could explain exactly what it is you're getting at. On the other hand, you could really use that as a smokescreen to kind of amuse your way and talk your way through. I had a friend who was very articulate who said that he'd always spend the hour amusing his therapist and walk away thinking, well, managed to get out of that one.
Yes,
you know,
that's absolutely right. And I think it worked to his disadvantage in therapy in that he's so brilliant and his mind is so active that he could process the things he was learning in such a way that they would turn into thoughts rather than. And that would take him away from the experiences from which those thoughts had begun. So when he said earlier that I seem to be trying to pull the carpet out from under him all the time, that's exactly right. That I somehow had to get him to discard or throw away what he'd already understood, so he could have some more fresh experience.
I'd like to get back to acting for a moment, John Cleese.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why? Oh, because you write the stuff, as I imagine, part of it.
Yes, but it's something else. It's something deeper than that. I've got a resistance to it. I think it's because I know actors well, and I know they spend all their time trying to impress people, and I don't like to admit there's a bit of me that does that just as much as any other actor. You know, there's a bit of me that wishes it wasn't like that. I didn't have to impress other people so much. You know, it's funny. It's one of the descriptions of me that always gets my hackles up. It's insane, isn't it?
In A Fish Called Wanda, you made a transformation from repressed barrister to a sexy leading man.
Yes. Well, right? Guess who wrote it?
Right. Well, I was wondering if that was your bid in a way to say, listen, I could play this part too. You know, I can be the leading man.
Well, there's so much happened after that film that was vaguely prophesied in the film that I'm not entirely sure how active or inactive my unconscious was, because in fact about 3 months after that film was shot I did actually split up with my second wife, and there's an odd parallel at that time between some of the things in the film and some of the things that are actually happening in my private life.
Do you have any other movies in the works?
No thoughts of them yet. I've got Well, that's not quite true. I got about 2.5 thoughts, but nothing's going to start getting put on paper, I reckon, until next Easter, because this book we're writing is difficult. I mean, it covers so much stuff. It covers value systems, religions, national cultures, business. I mean, it's just huge. And, of course, you get so interested, and you want to suddenly go off and read 6 books, and there isn't time to. So we want to enjoy writing the book. We refuse to give the publisher a deadline, which is good.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
John Cleese and his therapist, Robin Skinner. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.